엔투엔투 아 노알데미 Son skal det være. Ok, dere kan høre på meg. Bra. Ja. Det bedre nå? Greit. Vi kan starte det. Today's topic is cryptography. So last time on Thursday we talked about intrusion detection, now something quite different, which is how not to disclose information that you exchange between your opponent and you. We start with basic terminology. What is cryptology? Actually, it is a Greek word. Kryptos means secret. Any Greeks in the room? No. So kryptos means secret, and logos may mean many things, like word, language, meaning, science, but we take science, so that would be science of secrecy, something like that. So, to hide information. Now, this science consists of two branches. One is called cryptography, even though it's not only about, well, another Greek word, graphein, that means to write. So it's not only text. So we can, of course, encipher, well, you know this word, that is common knowledge. So to encipher means to convert the understandable information into some garbage. So we don't have only to encipher text, we can encipher video or audio or any kind of information. So that's one branch, to make ciphers. And the other is cryptanalysis, which is to break ciphers. So do the opposite. Now they are opposite, obviously, but they are also complementary. Complementary means that to make a secure system, you have to know how to break it. Or to break an insecure system, you have to know how the systems are made. So they are complementary from both sides. To summarize, cryptography develops methods of encipherment, this is called encipherment, in order to protect information. And cryptanalysis breaks these methods in order to reconstruct the original information. And on the slide 4, you have a general cryptographic procedure. So the main thing is actually not cryptography. The main thing is this, the channel of communication. So this part. So if there were no cryptography, we would use the channel as a means to transfer information from the transmitting side to the receiving side without any protection. So anybody can connect here and listen. So if the information is open, you just copy what is here and have the information. That's why on the telephone, well, in the old times, have you seen the movie Good Morning Vietnam or something? So on the telephone it's written, Charlie is listening. Charlie is Vietnamese, you know. So the enemy is listening. So without encipherment, anybody can listen here and get the information. To prevent that, you encipher on the transmitting side. Now, encipherment is a procedure with two inputs. One is the information that you want to hide, which is called plain text. So learn the terminology. plain text. Now, the other input is the information that helps this enciphering algorithm to hide this information. It's called the key. The key, as we are going to see in the future, is a random information. So something garbled. Now, on the receiving side, you must have an opposite algorithm to the encipherment, which is called deciphering algorithm. So encipher, decipher, you know this. Now, the decipher also has two inputs. One is coming from the channel, which is called ciphertext. So ciphertext is information that is not understandable to anybody that doesn't know the key. On this receiving side, in addition to ciphertext, the other input is the key. I didn't say that this key is the same as that key, but in some crypto system, it is. In some, we are going to see, there are differences. There are several keys, actually. One is known to anybody, and one is secret and known only by the deciphering side. Even it's not known by the enciphering side. This is called public key system. Now, you have the transmitting side, the receiving side. The transmitting side uses encipherment algorithm. The receiving side uses the decipherment algorithm. Both sides use the key. And key combined with the plain text in the encipherment algorithm makes the ciphertext. The ciphertext is sent through the channel. The channel is accessible by anybody. But now the evil party, the third party that doesn't know the key, cannot decipher, cannot get this information, plain text. On the receiving side, you have the deciphering algorithm, the key, and the input is the ciphertext, the other input, and you get the reconstructed plain text. Of course, this is simplified a lot because this channel is with errors. There is no ideal channel, so you have some bits, if it is digital communication, garbled here. So you have to solve for this. Now, when we talk about cryptology, we assume that this has been solved somehow. You can do it by employing error-correcting codes, for example, deliberately introducing redundancy in the information, and this redundancy is served to correct errors that may appear on the channel. This is usually done in many systems that we use every day and we don't think about that. Like in mobile telephone, it is done all the time. Now, the third party, the enemy. So this party is usually called A and this is B. So A for Alice and B for Bob. And this third party is usually called Eve in the books. Evil, you know. So the evil party that doesn't know the key and would like to get this information must break this cipher in order to get the information. And this process is called decryption. So you have encipherment and you have decipherment and you have decryption. So decryption is not the same as decipherment. So decipherment is legal when you know the key. And decryption is illegal when you don't know the key. You would like to get the plain text. For this, you must find the vulnerability in this cipher and exploit it. You must find a vulnerability, if any, because there are ciphers that don't have any. This process is called cryptanalysis, as we have said. So cryptanalysis is breaking ciphers. Now, this is British English. Encipherment, decipherment, decryption. Now, in American literature, decryption is the only term that exists. So when we say decipherment, it's something quite strange. So they also use decryption here. But then you don't distinguish between the real decryption when you don't know the key and the decryption when you know the key. Still, it's like that. So you have encryption, decryption, and decryption again, which is not very informative. So I shall continue using the British, even though the British accepted this decryption recently, have accepted it recently. To avoid confusion, I'm going to use these terms. Encipherment instead of encryption, decipherment instead of decryption, and decryption for cryptanalysis without knowing the key. So that's the general cryptographic procedure. How you hide the information in order not to be disclosed by the cryptanalyst. So, we have seen the key. Which is the key? The key information that must be present on both sides is the key. Now, how do you deliver these keys? Via what is called a secure channel. What is a secure channel? Well, you can model it in many ways. It can be physical. You physically deliver the key. But very often today, in modern times, you deliver this part of key by means of what I have mentioned before, the public key system. It's very common, although not so secure as it can be shown. The best thing is to deliver them physically somehow in advance, if you can. Of course, now everybody uses internet, browsing, etc., etc. How would you do that to millions of users to deliver the key physically? Because these browsers also use this kind of systems that needs the key in advance. Not every time, but very often. That's impossible. It's theoretically possible, but practically it's not possible. Because of that, they use these public keys. We are going to explain what it is, to deliver these so-called symmetric keys. So I'm going to talk about that just now. So these ciphers can be symmetric or asymmetric. In addition, symmetric ciphers can be stream ciphers and block ciphers. So we are going to explain all that. So in this secret key cryptography or symmetric, we have this shared key delivered to both parties somehow via a secure channel, which is modeled by many means, but one of them can be physical. Now, this asymmetric or public key has appeared recently, relatively recently, 1976. Well, that's recent for science. This makes use of a secret key and a public key, so two keys, not one. The advantage is that you don't need the secure channel. We are going to show, if we have time, how this is possible, just to indicate how it is done, because we don't have enough time for that. But it is possible to eliminate the need for the secure channel. But for this, you must have a public key, which is like a phone book. So next to the name of the recipient, you have his or her public key. And you have a secret key known only to the recipient. Even the sender, Alice, doesn't know Bob's secret key. If she wants to send information to Bob, she takes his public key, enciphers by means of public key, and Bob can decipher by means of his secret key. When it comes to symmetric cryptography, requiring a symmetric key to both sides, we have stream ciphers and block ciphers. The difference is that the encipherment transformation is applied to every symbol, say bit, if we are talking about digital communication. So to every bit, you apply this transformation. In block ciphers, you don't take just one bit, you take a lot of bits, like 128. That's typical for today. And apply the transformation to all the 128 bits at once. Then you take other 128 bits, that's called block. That's why it is called the block cipher. And apply the same transformation. So that's the difference between the stream ciphers and the block ciphers. Usually in the stream ciphers, this transformation is extremely simple, like sum modulo 2 bit by bit, XOR, exclusive OR. Whereas in the block cipher case, this transformation must be complicated. Because of that, it's time-consuming. And because of that, the block ciphers are usually slower than stream ciphers. So, stream ciphers can be very fast. They are used mainly in government applications. Not only there, but military, police, diplomacy. There are some civilian applications. For example, TLS that we use in our browsers. It uses this cipher called ChaCha20 currently. Before it was a cipher called RC4, which is also a stream cipher. But if you visit the website rc4nomore.com, you will learn that RC4 is a bad cipher, which is actually, well, it's not bad cipher by itself. It's badly initialized in most applications, and there are some difficulties with it. So it has been replaced by means of this one, by this one, ChaCha20, and that's the current state. Now this is very important because you use this cipher every day. You don't know that you're using it. It's transparent for the user. So when you contact some server, if the communication is to be enciphered or encrypted, as the Americans say, then they activate this automatically. The keys, since this is a symmetric cipher, stream cipher, the keys are delivered by means of a public key cipher. Now, during the Cold War, before 1989, there were some export limitations to the stream ciphers. You could only export from the US a cipher that is bad. So it had to be approved by somebody, state body in the US. They have to decide whether the cipher is bad enough to be exported. So a good cipher could not be exported. So the NATO countries had this Wassenaar arrangement that define the rules, how to do it. Because of that, the good stream ciphers were not suitable for public use. You couldn't use them. An example, as recently as by the year 2000, the Windows operating system came in two versions, one for the US and one for outside of the US, Windows NT4, maybe you remember that. So this Windows NT4, new technology 4, had the length of the key of 128 bits for encipherment in the US and 40 bits for encipherment outside the US. Now if we add one bit, it's exponential growth. So if you have 41 bit instead of 40, that means doubling the key space. So instead of 2 to the power 40, you have 2 to the power 41, which is 2 times 2 to the power 40. Okay? Now you can imagine 128 bits. How much more is that? So it's much more secure. It doesn't mean that you cannot have a bad cipher with 128-bit key. This badness would actually reduce the actual size of the key. The effective size would be shorter than 128 bits, but that must be a bad cipher. So a cryptanalyst would discover that vulnerability and exploit that to break the cipher. So there were some export limitations. I'm afraid with the situation in the world as it is now, this will be introduced again. Not yet. Block ciphers, on the other hand, they are not limited by these agreements. Because of that, they are very, very widely used. Unfortunately, they are, in general, slower and less secure because this transformation that must be complicated, it's very difficult to make a good one. So in general, it's better to use a stream cipher. But it depends on concrete solution. So you may have a good block cipher and a bad stream cipher. So then it's better to use a good block cipher, of course. The advantage, of course, no implementation and export limitations. In addition, if you really need a stream cipher because of the application, you can build one from a block cipher. That's called a mode of operation. And many modes of operation of block ciphers make actually stream ciphers of them. Not all, but many. So you can put, usually block ciphers are put in some kind of feedback structure. And this feedback structure makes them stream ciphers. Like cipher feedback mode and output feedback mode, these are typical. But there are stream ciphers made out of block ciphers that are not with feedback and very fast and very often used, and one of them is called counter mode. I don't think we shall have time to explain all this, but I'm just giving you indications of what you could learn if you take a crypto course. So we need a semester for that. So it is possible to build a stream cipher if you need one, starting from a block cipher. In addition, you don't have to know anything about ciphers to use ciphers, because there exists a block cipher that is a kind of standardized, that's called currently Advanced Encryption Standard since 2000. Before that, there was also a standard that was called Data Encryption Standard, or DES, which was broken, and because of that they introduced another one. Now, this is not without vulnerabilities either. There are some reports that a shortened version of this can be broken, but not reports that the whole cipher has been broken, which doesn't mean that it is not. But you know, sometimes vulnerabilities in ciphers that are discovered are not published. They are just exploited, because cipher is a military thing. So you can obtain great advantage by knowing a vulnerability of a cipher and exploiting it without publishing. These ciphers, block ciphers, are used a lot in practice because of these advantages. The only disadvantage is that they may be less secure than good stream ciphers. I was present on a lecture given by the professor Shepard from Britain in Madrid in the year 2000, and I'm quoting his words: every high-grade military cipher is a stream cipher. So if you really want to hide information and this is a high level of secrecy, you should use stream cipher that is good, of course, not a bad one. But for that, you have to know how to make it. So that was an introduction into cryptology. Now we are going to put that in a historical perspective, which means we are going to review some historical ciphers. Start with prehistory. Transposition ciphers, which is actually permutation of letters. So you take the message, you permute the letters, and that's it. Now, the permutation can be on the whole text, which would be great, it's better than a shorter permutation, but the thing is that it's computationally difficult. Well, it's difficult to do by hand. And in prehistory, they did it by hand. They didn't have computers. Because of that, they actually divided the text into blocks of short length, relatively short length, say n, and applied a short permutation to each group, which is actually the same that a block cipher does. Divide the plain text into groups of length n and apply a transformation to each group and the same transformation. This is a primitive block cipher. Now, the fact is, permuting letters of a plain text will not change the statistic of letters. So if you have five A's in this message, there will be still five A's, even though you permute the message. This can be exploited in attacks, the statistical methods. On the other hand, if you try all the possible permutations, especially if the permutation is long, that's very difficult, because the number of permutations is huge, and it grows very fast. It grows faster than an exponential function. So n factorial is the fastest known growing function. So it grows faster than an exponential function. So if you, for example, have 26 letters, that's 26 factorial. We are going to see how much is that. That's a huge number. You cannot do it in practice. And here is an example on the slide 11. If you have classical systems, that's our message, the plain text. We are going to use these terms, plain text. Yeah? Now, to get ciphertext, if you have the permutation of length 4, how do you read this permutation? The first letter goes to the fourth position. The second letter goes to the third position. The third letter goes to the second position. And the fourth letter goes to the first position. This is a permutation that is very, very short. So there are four factorial permutations. And that's 4 times 3 times 2. That's 24. So you try them all and you break the cipher. That's very easy. But if you have 5, that's already 120. You see, that's more than double. So faster growing than exponential. So, in our case, the first letter goes to the fourth position here. The second letter goes to the third position. The third letter goes to the second position, and the fourth letter goes to the first position. Then you repeat that for the next four letters, etc., etc. So you get something that nobody can understand. It's not classical systems any longer, so the ciphertext is like this. But if you count the letters, you still have two A's. You see? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 S's, etc., etc. So the statistics remains. That's a bad thing, because we are not talking random. You see? So the human language is redundant, and because of that, the statistics of the letters is not uniform. You don't have the same number of letters. The same holds for bigrams, 2 letters, 3 grams, 3 letters, etc., etc. So this is not uniform, because the language is not random. So this is a very, very simple cipher. Another one is called substitution. Substitution is more important, because there may be good substitution ciphers. The bad ones are monoalphabetic. So each occurrence of the same symbol of the plain text is substituted with the same symbol. So if you have an A, and the substitution is substitute A with a P, it's always substituted with a P. Whenever you find an A, you substitute it with a P. Okay? Now, another category is polyalphabetic ciphers. Polyalphabetic ciphers, an A is first time substituted with a P, the next time with maybe a B, the third time with an X, etc., etc. That's why it is called polyalphabetic. So this is possible to do. Actually, the particular substitution of one letter or one symbol depends on the key. So you have a key here. And in the monoalphabetic case, the key also exists, but the key is a permutation of the alphabet. Now, if you have English alphabet, 26 letters, or Norwegian, 29 letters, that's 29 factorial permutations. That's a lot. That's true. But the problem is with statistics. You don't have to break this monoalphabetic cipher by trial and error of the permutations. You may break it. You can break it by counting letters. here is an example of a general substitution. So any kind of substitution, you have an alphabet of, in this case, dimension 26, English alphabet, and you permute, you choose one of 26 factorial possibilities for the permutation, and you get one. Here is one of these permutations. Now this means A substituted with a P, B with L, C with O, D with K, etc., etc. But always, whenever you find an A in the plain text, you substitute it with a P. That's monoalphabetic. Now, the plain text, this is an example. T is substituted with an E, H with a U. So you use this table and you get a ciphertext. Now you notice that the same thing that happened with the permutation, with transposition cipher, happens here. You have two A's in the plain text. You also have two substitutions for an A in the ciphertext. You have two P's. Now it's a bit more complicated, but it's still simple, because you determine frequency of letters, and you compare the frequency of letters in the ciphertext with the frequency of letters in the language. Then you get the substitution, you reconstruct the substitution. Of course, for this, to make reliable statistics, you need a lot of text. On the short text, you cannot do it. You will have too many ambiguities. But if you have two pages of text, that's enough. You break it in a minute with a computer, in a second. So this is a bad cipher because of that. An example of a monoalphabetic cipher that was used in practice is Caesar cipher. Caesar cipher has a permutation, but this permutation is even simpler than this one, general. So this permutation is cyclic, you see? You just shift the alphabet, in Caesar's case by three letters to the left. So it's a cyclic shift of the alphabet, and that's the permutation. So there are just 26 possibilities for that, not 26 factorial, out of which one is whole cycle, which means 25 possibilities. The whole cycle is the same alphabet. You see? Now, in the case of English letters, in the case of Roman alphabet, that's 23 letters. They didn't have J, they didn't have W, and they didn't have U. So they have 23 letters, and the key was shifting cyclic by three positions to the left, which means A was always substituted with a D, B with a D, an E, C with an F, etc., etc. So that's Caesar's cipher. But it was used in practice 2,000 years ago, and it was good enough for that time. In addition, the bad thing here is the key is always the same, so the shift is always three. So you break one cipher, you break any message. If you know the shift. So the only thing that you need is a shift, not the permutation. So the general case of this kind of cipher is shift cipher. You may shift by 3, by 4, by 17, but that's the same. If you know the shift, so the only thing that you need to try to break this cipher is to try shifting by 1, by 2, by 3, etc., etc. In 25 trials, you get the cipher broken. So, a very bad cipher, but used in practice. Now, how to represent this mathematically? You see, it's a sum modulo the cardinality of the alphabet with the key. So this is a letter, call it XI, and ZI is the key letter. And the sum is modulo 23, which is the cardinality of the alphabet. Now, what is modulo? So you sum, divide by 23, and take the remainder. Okay? Of course, these must be numbers. So a simple conversion table is necessary. A is 0, B is 1, C is 2, etc., etc. And you get the numbers. Now, Z, the key, is always 3. The shift is 3, so it would be the same as substituted with a D, always. So, the example here, Vini, Vidi, Vinci, the famous Caesar's words, and the key is always a D, you sum with a D. A is 0, B is 1, C is 2, D is 3. You find the code for V. We must have a table. I can show you later because this table actually is not here, but you can draw it. So it would be V somewhere to the end, 20 maybe. Or we can count. This is 22, 21, 20, 19. So V would be 19. Then you add 3. That's 22, and that's Z. So that's it, etc., etc. So you get something that is not understandable if you don't know the shift. Of course, the generalization of this is shift cipher, where this Z is not 3. It's some number between 0 and the cardinality of the alphabet. Bad cipher. Now, another cipher with potential to be good is Wiesner cipher, which is polyalphabetic. This is a cipher that was known before this year, 1586, when it was published. There was a book by Blaise de Wiesner, which was a very high rank member of the court in Paris. Now, very similar to the Caesar cipher, you see, you have a sum of the plain text letter and the key letter modulo the cardinality of the alphabet. In the case of Wiesner, you have for encipherment the sum of the plain text letter and the key letter modulo the cardinality of the alphabet, say 26. And the decipherment is actually when you obviously subtract the key from the ciphertext. So that's how you decipher. Of course, everything taken modulo the cardinality of the alphabet. For this, of course, we have to convert to numbers these symbols, A is 0, B is 1, etc., etc. We can use the same table. As an example, let's encipher this French word for the wolf, loup. Actually, this is the key. So you repeat the key as long as the message is. And this is the message. I don't speak French, so this actually means in French, Paris is worth going to a mess. Why is that? It was these words are attributed to the French King Henry IV. He actually converted to Catholicism in order to become the king. And he said, I'm going to a mess, but I become the king. So I don't care about the mess. I show you them that I'm Catholic, but I'm not in my soul. Still I get the throne. This is just a digression. So any plain text, you see. Now, the key has to be repeated as many times as needed to cover the length of the plain text. Now you apply the formula to encipher. You see, sum the encoding for a P with the encoding for an L, where A is 0, B is 1, etc., etc., and you get the ciphertext cluster. The sum is modulo 26 because the French and the English alphabet have the same cardinality of 26. So you get something that is quite garbled. Now, you see an A in the plain text is the first time substituted with an O, the second time with a U. You see? And any other letter, R, well, R is just once, but say S, you see? Two letters that are beside each other. The first S is substituted with an M and another with an H. That's polyalphabetic. Why is that? Because the key letters are different. You see, for the first S is U, for the second S is P. To break this, you have to know the key. You have to guess it somehow. Here is an example on the slide 17 how you do it with the table and the formula. So A0, B1, C2, etc., etc., Z is 25. The plaintiff's letter is P. P is 15 from this table. The key letter is L in our example here, P with L, you see. L is 11. Sum these, 15 plus 11, that's 26. 26 divided by 26 is 1, and the remainder is 0. So that's how you get this 0. So modulo 26 means sum this, divide by the modulus, and take the remainder. Now consult the table, 0 is A. This is what we get for the first ciphertext letter. To decipher, we do the opposite. We take our ciphertext, which is an A, the encoding is 0, the key letter is L, which is 11, we have, you see, 0 minus 11. This is complicated. Well, complicated. If you do this on a computer, you get an error. Well, you get don't get an error on the computer. You get erroneous calculation because they compute minus 11 modulo 26 would be minus 11 modulo 26 would be minus 11. That's wrong on any computer. So you have to, if you program this, you have to write your own routine for this. Mathematically, minus 11 modulo 26 is minus 11 plus 26. So a modulus of a negative number, if it were 27, you would have to, that's just theory, but it cannot happen here, but minus 27 would be minus 27 plus 26, that's still minus 1, so you add 26 again. So as many times as necessary to get a positive number. So in our case, it cannot happen, of course, more than 26 in negative. So you get minus 11 modulo 26 is the same as minus 11 plus 26. That's very important calculation to know because it will be used many times, especially with public key, which is pure numerical calculation. And that's a P, actually the first letter of our plaintext. Of course, in 16th century, they didn't do this. They used a table. Now, this is the book, you see, in French, printed in 1586. But that cipher was known from before. And there are many ciphers in addition to that cipher in this book. And this is the man who wrote it. Now, in 16th century, they did it by means of a table, the calculation. So you take the alphabet, the first row is the alphabet from A to Z. Then, cycle shift by 1 to the left, second row, by 2, third row, etc., etc. You make a table, 26 times 26. Now, to encipher, you take, it's not seen very well, so the P is our plaintext, you see, and the L is our key letter. The intersection gives the ciphertext letter, which is the A. Now, to decipher, you need search. So you get an A, you have to actually find, you have the key, you see, on the deciphering side, in that particular column that belongs to the key letter, you have to find the ciphertext letter, and then the first letter in the corresponding row will be our plaintext letter. So this is how we decipher. So decipherment is slower than encipherment. To encipher, it's very easy. You take the row that corresponds to the plaintext letter, the column that corresponds to the key letter intersection gives you the ciphertext letter. to decipher, you have received this, but you have to find it in the column that corresponds to the key letter. So you have to search for it. You see? When you find it, the first letter of the corresponding row will give you the plain text. So this is the Vigenère table. Okay? Another variant of this cipher is Beaufort cipher, which is also polyalphabetic, very similar, uses the same table, but it computes in a different way. You see, if you subtract both times, then you have the same transform for encipherment and decipherment. You can, to get the ciphertext, subtract the plain text from the key. Modulo 26. Then, obviously, from this formula, you get the formula for the decipherment, which is to subtract the ciphertext from the key. So you have the same transformation to get the ciphertext and to reconstruct the plain text on the receiving side, which is practically useful. And of course, the example, this is the same old stuff, and now the key is wind. You repeat the key and use the same principle. Now, since the operation is the same, it's called involution. With the table, well, of course, with the formula, you do the same. More or less the same way. But with the table, you do the differently. You see, T is our plain text, and you search for the key letter in this row. And then the first letter of the corresponding column will give you the ciphertext letter. You see? So it will be the D. Now to decipher, you know the ciphertext letter, you find in the corresponding column the key letter, and then the first letter in the corresponding row will be the plain text letter. You search twice. So the encipherment is slower than with Vigenère. Decipherment is of the same complexity as Vigenère. Let's have a break. We continue at 10:15. 1, 2, 1, 2. Okay, shall we start? We have seen that the Bofors table is actually the same as Wiesner's table, but it's used differently. The advantage of the Bofors cipher over the Wiesner cipher is in involutiveness of the operation. So you can use the same operation for encipherment and the decipherment. Even though it's more time consuming to encipher, you can make a device that can use the same operation for encipherment and decipherment. It has been exploited during centuries. Now, these ciphers are bad in the sense that it is possible to break them because the key is repeated. It's a short, non-random word that is repeated. This is exploited in the cryptanalytic attack on this cipher. But this attack came in 19th century, and before that, it was considered a perfect cipher, impossible to break. But Kasiski in 1863, he showed that it is breakable, and actually it is. The thing is that you can make it unbreakable still, but we need some theory to explain that. Before that, we are going to explain electromechanical devices. So that was before computers, but after these manual devices. So the beginning of 20th century, more or less. What was the problem? You had to encipher more. And for that, you needed more time to do it manually. In addition, you could make mistakes. And when you make a mistake, then this mistake propagates. So the rest of the message is not possible to decipher. Because of that, and as the technology advanced, in the beginning of the 20th century, we were able to design electromechanical cryptographic devices which did not make mistakes, and they did it relatively fast compared to manual labor. Of all these machines, the most famous one is the bad one, the Enigma machine, which is a bad cipher. It's a cipher with a vulnerability. And there were better electromechanical machines that did not reach that popularity. Why is that? We don't know. The Enigma is an electromechanical machine that was patented at the end of First World War by a German engineer, Scherbius. And since that was the end of the war, it didn't find any military application before the Second World War. It was used for civilian purposes in post offices, etc., etc. And it was huge. It was this big. Because electromechanical devices need motors and all that, and that's heavy. Now, the advantage of the device was that it was an involution. And we have seen that with an involution, you use the same operation for encipherment and decipherment, which means you need one machine, not two machines on your site. So if you want to send messages, you need the same machine as the one that you use when you receive messages. That's a very good thing. In addition, the German army made the machine better by reducing the size, by making the involution out of it. And by the beginning of the Second World War, they use it massively. This is the principle on the slide 25, how it works. It has wheels. Some of these wheels may move, some don't. The moving wheels are called rotors, of course, and the not moving stators. Now you have a letter, and there is wiring on each wheel that has contacts, and to each letter is assigned one contact. And then the wiring determines a permutation. So the current flows not to the same contact for the same letter on the other side of the wheel, but to some other. You realize one permutation out of it. Then you use the next wheel with another permutation, then the third one with the third permutation, etc., etc. You have a multiple permutation. Now, this is a piece of cake to break, because there is an equivalent permutation. So instead of all these permutations, you can use one and thus break the cipher. However, that would be if all the wheels would move the same speed, which is not the case in the case of Enigma. Moving of one wheel determines moving of the second one. Then it's complicated to find the equivalent permutation. In addition, it is not always the same. It depends on the key. Then forget about breaking this way. Okay, so it was difficult to break it this way. That's why Enigma was so popular. However, it really had a vulnerability. We are going to talk about that later. So you have fixed wheels, stators, and mobile wheels, rotors. In the case of Enigma, because on the previous slide you had a principle, so you can have as many wheels as you like, but you have to make the machine small so you don't use too many wheels. You may have three or four rotors and two stators, the anti-wheel and the reflector. Reflector is something very specific for Enigma. It made it an involution. What is a reflector? The reflector is a thing that actually reverses the flow of the current. So this is the reflector on the slide 33. So when you press a key, for now, don't think about this one. This is an additional permutation. But in principle, and the original patent was like this, you press the key, then you go directly to the entry wheel, which is stator, and then you have one wheel, rotor, another rotor, the third rotor, and you have this reflector. And the reflector reverses the current and sends it another way through the same wheels. Actually, the existence of the reflector makes the machine involutive. So you need only one machine for encipherment and the decipherment. And that's actually the source of vulnerability the same way, because since you have to reverse the path of the current, then the current cannot go through the same letter. So if the letter was an A, then the reverse current cannot get through the same path, because that would be a short circuit. It's the current flowing, you see. Because of that, an A cannot be substituted by an A. So it's a small statistical bias. That was, as the British claim, exploited by them in this famous Bletchley Park. You have the movie Enigma and all this. It's all very, very exploited in commercial movies. Alan Turing was heading this department, etc., etc., the most famous British mathematician of the time. So they actually broke it. Now, it's not breaking like you break it like piece of cake. It was very complicated. They had electromechanical technology, several rooms full of machinery, and it was time consuming. So they didn't manage to break just any message, but they reconstructed many of them, and as the British claim, that decided the destiny of the war, which cannot be true, but it's important. So they broke it because there was a small statistical bias. You cannot substitute an A with an A, or a B with a B. So it's not random. It's not completely random, the ciphertext. And that was exploited. So they reconstructed the plain text by means of this. This additional part here is called the permutation, the Steckerbord in German. So that's actually an additional permutation. That was just like you press an A and the rest of the machinery acts as if you press some other letter, which is decided by this permutation, and this was regularly changed. So that additionally complicated the analysis, and it was introduced later during the war. It was not originally present. So that was an electromechanical machine. There are several slides here between the two that I have presented, but they actually summarize what I have just said. That's why I skipped them. So on the drawing, you get first how the machine was looking like. It was like a typewriter machine. It was not very big. was not very heavy. It was good to transport on a vehicle or something like that. So the Signal Corps of German Army, they use it extensively. The Navy version had more wheels. It was very important to protect the submarines, communication, etc., etc. Because of that, the Navy Enigma was even more complicated to break than the Army Enigma. Anyway, it was broken. Now, another electromechanical machine that was much better, theoretically, was invented before that in 1917 by Vernon in the US, and it was patented as a teletypewriter encipherment machine. In teletypewriter technology, you were not born when they were used. But anyway, you have something like a typing machine with a keyboard much like computers of today, and you have a card punch, tape punch, okay? And there was a code. Usually it was used a 5-bit code called International Telegraph Alphabet Number 2. That was massively used, 5 bits. A hole means a 1, and no hole means a 0 in that code. Now, with this you get 5-bit letters, letter encodings. And, for example, come soon would be like this. C-O-M-E blank space S-O-O-N. That was the encoding of the plain text. And you punch it with a special device, you get a tape with this. Now, you have a random key. Unlike the Vizhner, unlike Enigma, etc., etc., they used random key, whose length was the same as the length of the plain text. Of course, the random key is just garbage 5-bit letters that nobody understands. Then you sum modulo 2 bit by bit, you see? The XOR operation. 0 plus 0 is 0, 0 plus 1 is 1, 1 plus 0 is 1, but 1 plus 1 is 0. That's exclusive OR. You know that from digital electronics. Now, this is a very simple operation, but it ensures statistical, you see, equal number of zeros and ones, you see. Statistics of the output is perfect. If you have a random key, you have a random ciphertext. Since the random key's length is the same as the plain text length and nothing is repeated, no repeated letters, unless it is just random, then you cannot break it the same way as you break Vizhner cipher. Now, Vizhner cipher, consequently, can be extended to a Vernon cipher by using a random key that is not repeated. Instead of wolf or whatever was used in our examples, you need garbage. You need a random key of the same length as the plaintext, and then you get an unbreakable cipher, because this cipher can be shown to be unbreakable. And for this, the only requirement is that the key is random and that it is of the same length as the plain text. Why it is so? We may say something if we have time today. The only thing that is complicated is what is randomness. And there is a whole theory about that. But some practical randomness would be that this sequence passes the statistical tests. Of course, it's practical, it's not theoretical randomness. But even so, this is theoretically unbreakable. So much better than Enigma. Totally different principle, very, very simple encipherment transformation. And this is the key requirement, that the key is of the same length as the plaintext and that it is random. This is the code, International Telegraph Alphabet Number 2. So you have a special key on the keyboard when pressed will treat the rest of the keys pressed as digits, and press again, it will treat it as numbers. So you get, instead of 2 to the power of 5, which is just 32 characters, you get almost 32 times more possibilities, because at 1 bit it's double. So you have 2 times 32 at least possibilities. So you can encode many things, not just letters and numbers, but also exclamation points, etc., etc. So things like that. You see, this is the special encoding. Transition to figures, to numbers, and transition to letters. You press it, and then the next key that you press, it will be treated like a letter. So that's how they spared keys on the keyboard and used better the encoding. So this alphabet was very popular in teletype writers, and this is how it looked like. It was a keyboard, a piece of paper, a lot of electromechanical machinery inside, the motor and everything, and this is the punch. You see this part where you punch your typed message, and of course the key, it comes as another punched tape. And then there was a special device to perform this operation, a second device, not just teletype writer, sometimes attached to the teletype writer, which made this sum. You take two tapes as input, and you get one tape as the output, as the sum of these two tapes, modulo 2 bit by bit. So this is how you get the ciphertext, and then on the receiving side, the opposite. But that was technological advancement, colossal over the manual labor. The bit rate was 50 bits per second, up to 200 bits per second, the modern teletype writers of the 1970s. So they achieved, they were used in Reuters, for example, news agencies to transmit news in civilian purposes. Of course, for military purposes, obviously, for military messages. But very slow compared to today's speeds of communication, 50 bits per second, that's nothing. So, example, the quick brown fox jumps over the lazy dog. Why this message? Because it contains all the letters, and at the end there will be digits from 0 to 9. 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. So this was a test message. So you punch this using the ITA-2, International Telegraph Alphabet number 2, and that would be like this. So a whole means a 1. A non-whole means a 0. So you can consult a table, and for example, for the T, it's 10000, you see? That's this, 10000. These holes here, they were used as a lead for the tape. So there was a gear that was moving the tape, and it used these small holes. So this is not the part of the encoding, only the big ones, etc., etc. So the message for testing teletype writer would be the quick brown fox jumps over the lazy dog. So we finalized this lecture by a discussion on security of cryptographic solutions. We are going to maybe refer to some of the classical solutions that we have reviewed so far, and we are going to introduce some measures of security. So the question is, how much security is offered by a cipher system? Since you are asking, that implies that there must be a measure of security. So it must exist. But it's not easy to define such a measure, because not all aspects of measuring security actually indicate real security, as we are going to see in our examples. A desirable property of a cipher system would be that if you are a cryptanalyst, you don't know the key, you cannot decrypt the plain text by trying all the possible keys, because there are too many keys. Now we are going to show that this is not enough. So there may be a cipher that guarantees that you cannot decide on what message was sent, even if you are capable of trying all the possible keys. And that's called perfect secrecy. And that's what we mentioned when we talked about Wernham cipher, that it is really perfectly secret, and we are going to show, not mathematically, but intuitively, how this works. As an example of not this being enough, just to be able to not to be able to break the cipher by enumerating all the possible keys. Here is an example. You take any monoalphabetic cipher, substitution, as we have seen. You have alphabet of 26 letters, if this is English. Each key is a permutation of the alphabet, and they are equally likely, which means it would be as if you picked a permutation of letters at random. So there is no way for the cryptanalyst of knowing which particular permutation you have used. And there are 26 factorial of these permutations, which is a huge number. Now, another requirement is that you have a relatively long plain text, which is more than 25 letters for English. Why is that? We are going to say later. So if you have all this, you know the alphabet, you know how the permutation was used, but you don't know the permutation. And you know that the plain text is longer than 25 letters, then you can break the cipher. Now, you don't break it by enumerating all the possible permutations, because this is the number. 26 factorial is, I cannot read this number. It's a lot of digits. Now, how much is that? If you need 1 nanosecond to check one key, that would be, even today, very, very fast machine. But theoretically possible. Then you need this many years, 1.28 times 10 to the power of 10 years. That's 10 billion years to enumerate all this, to try all the possible keys. You cannot do it. The question is, this is enough for security? No, because you can, as we have seen, break this cipher not by trying all the possible keys, but by statistical means. You count the letters and you compare these frequencies of letters with the frequencies of letters in the language. So it's not enough that you are not capable of enumerating all the possible keys to proclaim a cipher secure. So this is not enough for defining security. Now, another question, well, the opposite question. Suppose that the cryptanalyst does actually have resources, which means time, to try all the possible keys. Say he or she has 10 billion machines and tried everything in parallel. Theoretically possible, but practically impossible. But anyway, suppose that they have. The question is, can he or she determine the plain text if they can actually enumerate all the possible keys? The answer is surprising, not necessarily. So the question is, what plain text was sent out of all the possible plain texts? So that's what the cryptanalyst has to answer. So I can enumerate all the possible keys, and I still don't know which plain text was sent. How that? Like this. You see, if you have 4 plain texts and 4 ciphertexts, and to get 1 ciphertext, you need 1 different key. So you take the first plain text, you apply 1 key, the first key, you get the first ciphertext. You apply the second key, you get the second ciphertext. You apply the third key, the third ciphertext. You apply the fourth key, the fourth ciphertext. Do that for every plain text. And now, since there is a small number of keys, I can enumerate them all. I can try one key. I get this one. For example, Y1, the first ciphertext. I try one key, get this plain text. I try another key, get this plain text. I try another key, get this plain text. I try the fourth key, get this plain text. But which one was sent? I don't know. So I have tried all the possible keys, and I got all the possible plain text, but I still don't know which one was sent. So if you have equal number of plain text and ciphertext, and the keys are chosen at random, you cannot decide, even though you can enumerate all the possible keys. So that's the point. So such a cipher is called perfect cipher. This is why we distinguish between theoretical security or perfect secrecy and the practical security. Theoretical security means the system is secure against an attacker with unlimited time and computational resources. So he or she can enumerate all the possible keys. And an example is the Wernham cipher, which is also called sometimes one-time pad. Now, why one-time? Pad is something that you have beside your things. From this pad, you choose the key. Now, why one-time? There is an attack. If you repeat the key for the two different plain texts. Since we are talking about exclusive OR, if we have the plain text P1 and the plain text P2, and then we repeat the key, this is the XOR symbol, sum modulo 2 bit by bit, so I need the key for enciphering the first plain text and the same key for enciphering the second plain text. I get the ciphertext C1 here and the ciphertext C2 here. Now, this is bad. Why is this bad? Because if I sum these two equations, what I get is P1 plus P2 plus K plus K equal to C1 plus C2. Now, exclusive OR means 1 plus 1 is 0, 0 plus 0 is 0. So this will be 0. Okay, so the key disappears. P1 is not random, P2 is not random. C1 I know, C2 I know, I have listened on the channel. Because of that, I get something that I know, call it asterisk, which is the sum of two non-random sequences. This is easy to break by statistical means. That's why we have to use the key and throw it away and never repeat. So this Wernham cipher is like that. You have to use the key only once. That's the third condition. It has to be random, it has to be the same length as the plain text, and it has to be used only once. And this is called Kerckhoff's attack, according by the name of the cryptographer that first described it. So this is easy to do. So this is theoretical security. One-time pad is actually can be shown to be like that, because you have the same number of plain texts as the number of ciphertext. You can try all the keys, and you get the plain text that you don't know which one was sent. That's under the assumption that all the plain texts are actually used and mean something, which is a very strong assumption, as we are going to see. Now, practical security, the system is secure against an attacker with limited time and computational resources, which means if we have a crypto system that whose security lies on difficulty of some mathematical problem, like this one, RSA, you have all heard of this. This one is based on difficulty of factoring large numbers. So if you have a 1,000-digit decimal number, which you know that it has two prime factors of approximately the same size, to factor this number, you need substantial computational effort, very, very huge computational effort. With 1,000 digits, nobody can do it with known methods so far. So this is practical security, because there is no guarantee that tomorrow somebody will not invent an algorithm that will break, that will actually factor these large numbers. And it has been registered before. In the beginning, RSA is very widely used. In banks, for example, Bank ID in Norway, they use RSA with 2048 bits of key. When you use Bank ID, you use this crypto system. It's a public key system. Now, before it was 1024 bits, 5-6 years ago, and then they switched to 2048. Why? Because 1024 bit numbers, some exemplars of these bad numbers, were factored. With present technology, then you double the number of bits. Add one bit, it doubles the size, you know, of the key space. So this is actually a huge number, but who knows that tomorrow somebody will not invent very ingenious way of factoring integers. So this is practical security. So this is not perfectly secret, but it's good enough in practice. It's very widely used. So perfect secrecy was studied by Shannon in 1949. That was the famous paper, The Communication Theory of Secrecy Systems, from which we usually count the scientific period of cryptography. Before that, we used ciphers. For example, the Vernon cipher was invented in 1917. It was perfectly secret, but nobody knew that. So Shannon proved that it was perfectly secret. And since then, since 1949, we are talking about scientific period of cryptography. So a crypto system is perfectly secret if the plain text, say X, is statistically independent on the cryptogram Y. Cryptogram is when you don't know the key. Otherwise, it's ciphertext. It's the same thing, but you call it cryptogram if you don't know the key. If you know the key, you can decipher, you call it ciphertext. So for all the possible plain text and all the possible cryptograms, which means the conditional probability that the plain text X was sent if the ciphertext Y was received is the same as the unconditional probability that the plain text X was sent, which means getting the ciphertext means nothing to you. So it will give no information about the plain text. That means statistically independent. So if it is statistically independent, you don't care about the ciphertext at all. You just have to guess the plaintext. So this is a definition of a perfectly secret crypto system. And as we have demonstrated on these examples, it is possible to do. This is achieved if one time pair. There is exactly one key transforming each plaintext to each cryptogram, and all the keys are equally likely. An example of a cipher is the Vernon cipher, but it may be non-binary cipher, like this one. If the symbols are from the alphabet 0 to L minus 1, not L is not equal to 2, it may be 3, 4, or something. So for all them, the same holds as with the binary case. The enciphering transformation in general case with L, not with 2, is sum modulo L, not sum modulo 2. It's not XOR, it's sum modulo L. Maybe sum modulo 3 or sum modulo 4. If you use ternary alphabet, that's sum modulo 3. But the same holds. The number of keys, plain text and ciphertext, of course, because they have to be of the same length, is L to the power of N, not 2 to the power of N as in the binary case. But that's the same. So it is actually perfectly secret. Why? Because there is exactly one key transforming each plain text to each cryptogram. Even if you can try all the possible keys, you don't know which plain text was sent. So that's this example. That's why this cipher is perfectly secret. Now, we have mentioned this thing. This is, of course, a strong assumption because it requires that all the possible plain texts mean something, that they are meaningful. Now, the human language is redundant. It's not true that all the possible combinations of letters mean something. You can make a random page of 2048 letters that don't mean anything. So this would be if really any plain text is meaningful, which is not true in practice. Now, then there is another measurement of security, which is called unicity distance, etc., etc., but we don't have time for this, and if you take the crypto course, you will learn something about that. So it's better to use that unicity distance, call it like this, even though we haven't defined it, than the measure of impossibility of enumerating all the possible keys. Finally, we are going to say a couple of words about practical ways of breaking ciphers. And with this we finish. Like monoalphabetic ciphers, we have already said how we can break them. The statistical properties of the plain text are preserved, retained in the ciphertext. That's really bad, because the method to break it would be like this. Count the letters in the ciphertext, and then count the letters in the language. Take a thick book, say a Bible, count the letters in that book, and then you will see that E is, for example, the most frequent letter, and then in your ciphertext you have a P that is most frequent. Then P must be a substitution for an E. So this is how it works. But this is the simplest case. You can also count bigrams, trigrams, etc., etc., not just one letter, but also two letters, because it's all characteristic for every language, and it has been counted for many languages. And I'll give you a couple of examples. In the English case, you have E, which is the most frequent letter, which is 12%, almost 13% of all the letters. If you take any thick book, it must be many letters, like Shakespeare or something, dramas, you get this. So 13% E, 9% T, 8% A, etc., etc. And rarely Z, rarely Q, things like that, F. So the smaller the frequency, the more information the letter brings. That's from information theory. We don't care about this. But the frequencies matter. So you just count the letters in your cryptogram, and if you get a letter that is around 13%, it must be a substitution for an E. If the cryptogram is long enough, of course. On short cryptograms, you cannot do anything with any method. For Norwegian, for example, from this source, you have E also, the most frequent letter. But then N and R are more frequent than a T, which is the next most frequent in English. So N and R have around 9%, but it's all similar. Yeah? So these two languages have very similar characteristics regarding frequencies. Of course, in Norwegian you have these very rare letters A, O, but they are rare, less than 1%. So this can be used to break monoalphabetic ciphers. Then we have the Wiesner cipher, but the bad case, where you don't have the random key. You have this loop, 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 repeated. So the key is not random, it is repeated. The first thing you have to do, and we are talking about this Kasiski's method from 1863, from 19th century. So what you have to do is first to determine the length of the key. Once you determine the length of the key, then you can break down the problem of breaking a polyalphabetic cipher into several monoalphabetic ciphers. Actually, these monoalphabetic ciphers are very bad monoalphabetic ciphers. They are shift ciphers. So like Caesar's cipher, it's very easy to break them. You even don't have to frequent letters to determine frequency of letters. You just try the shift. It's much easier than the method for general monoalphabetic ciphers that we have talked about, comparison with the table of frequencies in the language. You don't have to do it, because it's a shift cipher. So, if the length of the key is 4, you get 4 shift ciphers to break, instead of one polyalphabetic. It's extremely easy. You can do it by hand, to say nothing about computers. So, actually, this cipher is easy to break if the key is not random, and if it is not of the same length as the length of the plaintext. But if it is, you cannot do this. If it is of the same length as the length of the plaintext, and if it is random, and all the keys are equally likely, then it converts itself into a Wernham cipher. Although it's not sum modulo 2, it's sum modulo 26, the cardinality of the alphabet. Well, if any, 29 in Norwegian. But anyway, we have shown that actually the perfect cipher is this one. It doesn't have to be binary. It can be modulo 26. So we can break the Wiesner cipher if it is in original form. So non-random key repeated. Now, how do we get the length of the key? We actually use autocorrelation. What is autocorrelation? You have one sequence, you shift it by 1, by 2, by 3, etc., etc., and you sum and see the number of ones. Or if you don't sum, you can count the number of agreements and disagreements. It's the same. With this, you will get peak at the length of the key. We are going to actually demonstrate that on an example. This is our cryptogram. You will see that it is a polyalphabetic cipher. It's not the same substitution for each appearance of the same symbol. No, you don't understand anything here because it's garbage. Now, we try possible lengths of the key, 1, 2, 3, etc., etc., and compute this autocorrelation until we get a peak. If you try 1, 2, 3, 4, etc., etc., for 5, you get the maximum number of coincidences between the ciphertext, the cryptogram, and its shifted version. Shifted by 5, and you get most agreements, 24. That's why the method is called incidence of the coincidence. You see how many times you get the coincidence. 24 times in this case. You can do it at home by hand, or you can make a simple program to do that. In this case, you will actually conclude that the length of the key is 5. Actually, I have made this program, and I'm going to send it to Bjorn, and then you will be able to download it and execute it. And you will see that it's very easy to get, by means of a computer, this. And also by hand. Now, what we get when we know the length of the key is take the first, and then the sixth, and then 11th, etc., etc. letter, you get one shift cipher. Then the second, the seventh, etc., etc., the second shift cipher, etc., etc. You get 5 shift ciphers. The only thing is to break these shift ciphers, and this is what you can do in many ways. You can try the shift. You can do it even more intelligently by frequency of the most frequent letter, what is done in this program. Then once you get the substitution for the most frequent letter, then the substitutions for the other letters are obtained easily by means of the subtraction. Just subtract the frequency of that letter with the encoding of that letter, subtract encoding for E from that, modulo 26, because it's a shift cipher. The shift is the same for all the letters. That's it. Very easy to break. So you actually reduce the problem of breaking the polyalphabetic cipher, which is impossible to break, the other means, into the small problems. The shift cipher cryptanalysis is extremely easy. The number of these shift cipher problems is equal to the length of the key. So the key step is here actually to determine this incidence of the coincidence, which is the length of the key. For this method to be successful, you need some amount of text. If the text is too short, then you get too many ambiguities. Now, cryptanalysis is art, it's not craft. So it's always a matter of guessing intelligently, etc., etc. You cannot just apply some method. Even here, if you have ambiguity, then you try one, and then if you get something that is not good, you try another possibility, etc., etc. What you have to do is to make sure that the number of these possibilities is not too large. That would be all for today. You will get these recordings and software and everything.